mass voter purges in Georgia and Wisconsin have voting rights advocates concerned ahead of 2020.
It's not just the purge, it's voter ID, it's changes to the registration process, it's changes to student ID processes, redistricting, and it's a systemic effort for a decade to make it more difficult to vote.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for December 18th, a look at how the battle over voting rights is playing out in individual states. Also on the show, a citizenship law in India has drawn international condemnation, but countries including the U.S. appear unlikely to follow up on threats of sanctions.
Given these developments, no one really believes that the statements that are coming out of the United States would amount to anything more than statements of concern. I don't think anyone really seriously thinks here that there could be sanctions.
We've got a quick hitter today, so let's get to it. Across the country, states are continuing to purge voters from their rolls in advance of the 2020 election. From 2016 to 2018, 17 million voters were pulled from state registration systems, and that's according to a report from the Brennan Center for Justice. In the past week alone, judges in Wisconsin and Georgia approved mass voter roll purges in their states. And in Wisconsin, 234,000 voters were ordered to be removed for failing to report their current address. In Georgia, roughly 313,000 voters could be removed from the state's rolls for failing to update their address and for not participating in an election in 7 years. With Republicans and Democrats gearing up for a 2020 fight where every vote counts, key states like Wisconsin and Georgia care more than ever about who's on their voter rolls. Joining me now are Mark Nisi, a Georgia government reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Mayon Silver, a reporter for WUWM in Milwaukee. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Mayon, let's start with you. In Wisconsin, we said that 230,000 voters could be removed from the state's voter rolls for not updating their addresses. The original date on this, however, was supposed to be in 2021. Why is it happening now? Who was behind that?
Yeah, so a conservative group filed a lawsuit. They're called the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Basically, the Wisconsin Elections Commission, every few years before an election, there's like a data matching process, and they see which voters may have moved because these voters interacted with maybe the DMV or the U.S. Postal Service. So they send out these letters, and they ask people to confirm their addresses. The Election Commission was giving up to 2021 for voters to do this because they didn't completely trust whether it was flagging the right people who had moved, whether everybody had actually moved. This actually happened before in the election cycle, before the February 2018 primary. And the Election Commission found that people were showing up at the polls and they hadn't moved, and then they were deactivated. So the Election Commission decided to be a little more conservative about it. It's a bipartisan commission made up of Republicans and Democrats, and they voted 5-1 to give these 2 years. So this conservative group didn't file a lawsuit back in 2018 during the midterms, but they decided to come forward now and say that they want to clean up the rolls and that Wisconsin has this statute that says that the voters should be deactivated after these mailings after 30 days instead of 2 years.
And Mark, in Georgia, the most recent voter purge, I should say, has been driven by something called the Use It or Lose It law. And that means if you haven't voted in 7 years, you're off the rolls. How does that work? How common is that?
Georgia is one of about 9 states that has this kind of law that removes voters for inactivity, no contact with election officials or no participation in elections. And out of the more than 300,000 names that were removed from Georgia's voter registration list Monday night, the inactive voters made up nearly 120,000 of those.
Now, we know that Stacey Abrams was behind the effort to stop this voter roll purge in Georgia. Mark, on Monday, a judge said the purge could move forward, but then agreed to schedule more hearings on this later in the week. That just seems incongruent to me. What's happening there?
Well, there was a last-minute court effort to stop the cancellation process on Monday. It was scheduled to take place Monday night, and when we got into federal court on Monday, the judge asked both sides, well, what's the harm of me letting it go forward tonight? It's been planned for months and months. And if I find that some voters shouldn't have been removed, I can just order you to put those voters back on, but you're coming to me here with this last minute request, and the judge wanted more time to review it. So he allowed the cancellation process to go forward with the caveat that he'll hold another court hearing on Thursday and may decide that some of those voters that were canceled should be reactivated.
Mayan, in Wisconsin, who are the people that are most affected by these purges?
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did a study on this particular purge, and they found that it would disproportionately affect Democratic urban areas. The letters went out to about 7% of Wisconsin's registered voters in the entire state, but they were concentrated in the areas of Milwaukee and Madison, which are the big urban areas. And the Journal Sentinel found that about 23% of the letters were sent to Milwaukee and Madison, even though it only accounts for 14% of registered voters.
And when you say urban areas, are we inferring there that those are largely communities of color or poor communities, or how does that break down?
Yes, they tend to be younger people in the urban areas, tend to move more often. There's a larger minority population. Wisconsin as a whole tends to be rather white and rural, and Milwaukee and Madison have a higher concentration of minority voters. In fact, Milwaukee is a majority minority city.
So, Mayan, how are people finding out about this? I mean, I'm assuming they're not getting a text message that's alerting them to the fact that they're about to be removed from the rolls. Is this still paper mail?
Yeah, so people are getting letters in the mail, and I talked to one voter who's actually a canvasser for a union, and she said that she got it in the mail, and she had moved, but she didn't know what it was. She didn't trust it. She didn't realize she had to re-register, and she actually said her grandmother got a letter and hadn't moved. She was very suspicious about it. There was an appeal recently filed by the Wisconsin Department of Justice on behalf of the Elections Commission in state court, but the League of Women Voters filed a federal lawsuit on Tuesday in federal court, and they're alleging that these letters are due process violations because they're not telling people exactly what's happening to them. They certainly didn't tell them that they had 30 days before they were going to be deactivated. And so there's going to be some battles in both federal and state court.
Mark, same questions for you over in Georgia. Who's most affected by these voter roll purges?
In Georgia, it's interesting, at least this year, that when you might have expected that there would be racial and geographic disparities, we haven't been able to detect those. In Georgia's cancellation list, the amount of voters being canceled is relatively consistent with their share of the voting population as a whole. So while many other examples of voting practices that change access to the polls, such as poll closures, for example, do have a racial impact, that isn't showing up in this year's cancellation process.
Let's talk about same-day registration, Mayan, because that seems to be what some groups are saying is the solution to all this. It won't disenfranchise. But how easy is it? What does the process look like for same-day registration?
Wisconsin enacted a fairly strict voter ID law in 2011. And since then, there's been some research on it. Basically, people have to show up at the polls with a photo ID and some sort of proof of residence. And, you know, some academics like Professor David Meyer from UW-Madison, they did research studying voter ID based on the 2016 elections. And they found that it did have an effect on voters, and it did impact voters of color, voters in poverty, people that tend not to have access to be able to pay for the documentation, or who don't necessarily have a car, or who move more often from into Wisconsin from out of state. So, you know, it is something that is an issue, and it is affecting people, and people are saying that same-day registration is not necessarily a cure-all, because what would have been a really easy show up to the polls is now something that is a bureaucratic hassle. The interesting thing is that sometimes conservative groups are saying that these measures are to prevent voter fraud in Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin Elections Commission says that from February 2018 to February 2019, it turned up 24 cases of suspected voter fraud out of 2.7 million votes cast in the November midterms. And the year before, there were 7 voter fraud cases. So this isn't something that's, you know, bearing out in the numbers.
Mark, same thing. A question to you. I mean, there are many obstacles, as you mentioned, in Georgia, including the closure of polling places, in addition to this sort of voter roll purge. But there are people in Georgia that say voting's easy. I mean, you have automatic voter registration. Is that the answer to this?
There are so many things going on with elections that both increase and limit access. And in general, more people are being added to Georgia's voting rolls than are being subtracted. And that is largely because of automatic voter registration. When people get their driver's licenses, they are automatically signed up to vote unless they opt out. And that is adding tremendous numbers of people to Georgia's voting rolls, about 500,000 in the last year and more than 350,000 the year before that. And that's largely because Georgia is a growing state. People are moving to Georgia and signing up to vote when they get their driver's licenses.
And I want to talk politics here in the remaining 2 minutes that we have in the segment. Mark, Democrats are saying, at least, that Georgia is showing signs of going blue for the first time in decades, which could indicate that this is politically motivated, these voter purges. How much truth is there to that?
It's hard to tell how politically motivated they are, but this has been the practice and law in Georgia for a number of years now. This method of canceling voters every other year is something that has been happening for years. It does seem like the numbers have risen in recent years, but this is not a new process.
And Mayon, in 2016, we know Trump won Wisconsin by less than 23,000 votes. It was not a landslide victory for the president. Talking politics over there, how does that play in here? Is this politically motivated, or could it be politically motivated as we head into 2020?
Trump, it was a very close race in 2016. And by all accounts, Wisconsin is going to be really, really close in 2020. That it's going to be, you know, there's a lot of different factors that are working in Wisconsin for Democrats. There's a growing population in diverse cities, but it's also home to a lot of white voters without a college degree. So, you know, basically, this could take off tens of thousands of people who were wrongly flagged as movers, and they, you know, it could prevent people from getting to the polls. We don't know if it's, you know, we don't know how those people are necessarily going to vote or what their voting habits are. But, you know, even if people should have moved, you know, there are professors who say that it's not necessarily important to look at the numbers in the aggregate, that tens of thousands of people could be prevented from voting. It's if one person is prevented from getting to the polls, and that this is part of a systemic effort to prevent voting. It's not just the purge, it's voter ID, it's changes to the registration process, it's changes to student ID processes, redistricting, and that it's a systemic effort for a decade to make it more difficult to vote.
Mark, do you feel the same way about what's playing out in Georgia? Specifically has how it relates to what's going to happen in 2020.
We'll see what happens in 2020, but I do think that we'll see incredible turnout and incredible interest. There, the Secretary of State in Georgia predicted that turnout will exceed well over 5 million in 2020's presidential election. This is in a state that has just over 7 million registered voters, so that's very high turnout. And during last year's election for governor, too, we had record turnout for that election for a midterm. So there's high interest, people are involved, and it will be a very close and competitive race, I believe.
Mark Nisi is a Georgia government reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Mayon Silver is a reporter for WUWM in Milwaukee. Mark, Mayon, thanks to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology and small goals to change habits with the goal of losing weight and keeping it off for good. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Mass protests are raging across India over a new law called the Citizenship Amendment Act. The law creates a fast track for immigrants from neighboring countries to obtain Indian citizenship, that is, unless they're Muslim. And this is just the latest in a string of anti-Muslim policies set forth by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which has many demonstrators worried that the world's largest democracy is on the path to becoming a non-secular Hindu state. Here's a group of students reading from India's constitution at a protest this week.
The people of India, having solemnly resolved to constitute India
into a sovereign, socialist, secular,
democratic
republic.
And in response to the protests, UN officials and Human Rights Watch have issued statements of concern. And despite Prime Minister Modi's amicable relationship with President Trump, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedoms has threatened India with sanctions. For more on this, I'm joined by Supriya Sharma, executive editor of the Indian news publication Scroll.in, and she joins us now from New Delhi. Supriya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina. Thanks for having me on.
So what is the government, the Indian government's argument for essentially excluding Muslims from the list of religions in this legislation?
Tanzina, the Indian government has argued that these changes have been introduced in the citizenship law solely out of humanitarian concern for refugees escaping religious persecution in these three countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan. But as critics have pointed out, the government's humanitarian concern is rather selective and arbitrary. It's limited to just the religious minorities in three Muslim-majority countries in India's neighborhood. So people are asking, why are these refugee groups not eligible for asylum and citizenship in India?
Prime Minister Modi has also been criticized for essentially wanting to stir up tensions between India's majority Hindus and its minority Muslim community. Is this a real example of that playing out?
Yes, absolutely. The change in the citizenship law needs to be seen against the backdrop of the Modi government's plans to prepare a national register of citizens. Basically, the government wants to screen all Indian citizens afresh. In the process, it could ask people to produce documents to vouch for their citizenship, and those who are unable to do so could end up being declared undocumented migrants. Now, given the recent changes in the law, there are fears that this process could leave Indian Muslims uniquely vulnerable, since members of other religious communities might still have an option of citizenship by naturalization, which this law denies to Muslims.
This has triggered widespread protests around the country. Tell us what the state of those protests are today.
Tanzina, the initial protest against this law took place in India's northeast region, where local communities fear getting swamped by migrants. In the state of Assam last week, we saw intense protests which led to a police crackdown. 5 people were killed in police firing. But most significantly, we're now seeing protests across Indian universities and colleges. So the protests have become extremely broad-based. Last we counted, there were more than 60 universities and colleges where demonstrations have taken place, and more are being planned. Again, the turning point was really the events that we saw on Sunday when the police stormed the Jamia University in Delhi, firing tear gas inside a library where students were busy reading books. We saw the police was beating up students brutally. And as soon as the news filtered out, it had an electrifying effect where students in faraway cities started pouring out on the streets to protest. It's been 3 days since then, and the protests continue to spread to more campuses.
Supriya, President Modi visited the United States earlier this year and met with President Trump in September. What has that relationship looked like between the two leaders?
Tanzina, you might have seen the pictures where Prime Minister Narendra Modi walked step in step with President Trump. In fact, he held his hand and he took him around. Those images traveled back to India where this was seen as a sign of a great relationship between these two leaders. In fact, many television stations in India beamed those images to say, well, Modi is now a world conqueror. This is the first time that the Indian Prime Minister has gone and won over a large audience in the US. However, while there have been statements coming from the US government, from the Commission for Religious Freedom, they have expressed concerns. Almost no one in India seriously believes that any of this could actually damage the relationship between the Modi regime and the Trump administration, given that basically both these leaders share a very nationalistic hardline politics.
I want to talk a little bit about both of those issues. I mean, we know that a U.S. federal commission is calling for sanctions against India and any other leadership, Home Minister Amit Shah specifically, if the country moves forward with this bill. Is that a real threat? Does that fall on deaf ears?
Most people in India don't think that's a real threat. That's also partly to do with the impression that Indians have of the Trump regime. They haven't seen it act against authoritarian leaders elsewhere in the world. It doesn't seem like that would happen with India either. The last few months, we have seen very troubling developments in India. For instance, in August, the Narendra Modi government took away the special constitutional status of Jammu and Kashmir, India's only Muslim-majority province. It broke up the state into two, downgraded its status to territories governed by Delhi. It's been 4 months since then, but 7 million people are still living without internet access. For weeks, even phone lines were down. Kashmiris are totally cut off. Many people have been detained. Political leaders have been put under arrest. Despite this complete clampdown in Kashmir, we haven't really seen much of a response. The U.S. Congress held hearings and may have expressed concern. But given these developments, no one really believes that the statements that are coming out of the United States would amount to anything more than statements of concern. I don't think anyone really seriously thinks here that there could be sanctions.
To that end, I mean, in some ways, the Citizenship Amendment Act that we've been talking about, which targets Muslims specifically, could be compared to President Trump's Muslim travel ban. Is that an accurate comparison to make?
Quite so, yes. It's very clear that essentially this is a law that discriminates against Muslims. And so it clearly resonates with the travel ban introduced by the Trump administration.
And there are also talks, at least from what we understand, of detention camps that could be set up for Muslims. Are those similarities in how our two countries are viewing immigration specifically?
It's a little more complicated because these detention camps have actually already been in existence. These are not detention camps for Muslims specifically, but they have basically ended up incarcerating anyone who's Bengali speaking, who lives in eastern India. This is the region that borders Bangladesh, where there have always been concerns of migration from Bangladesh. Here again, it's important to point out that the National Register of Citizens, which Modi government wants to now implement across India, which is essentially stoking anxieties among Indian Muslims, that has already been implemented in the state of Assam in eastern India. It basically ended up leaving 2 million people quasi-stateless. We know that the government's building more detention camps in that state. And we know that previously those who have been sent to these detention camps have narrated really heart-rending stories, almost torture-like situation. The fear now is that if this National Register of Citizens is prepared for all of India, we could end up with a situation where many genuine Indian citizens might not be able to prove their citizenship purely because many poor people do not have documents like birth certificates. These concerns are looking very serious.
Supriya Sharma is the executive editor of the Indian news publication Scroll.in. Supriya, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tansina.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.